So this is day after Human Rights Day, 22nd of March 2018. Day of the great clouds. It's like doing retreat in Europe. It's cozy and you can just nestle in. Have a wonderful time. We often find that we use consciously or otherwise a particular image in our meditation, in our practice, in our life as a whole, but particularly in our meditation, that I am going to suggest is not so helpful. We have a sense, one way or another, that of a kind of a static enlightenment, clarity, kindness, attentiveness, a sort of a model of a kind of solid, unified field of attention that in which everything appears clear and bright and uninterrupted. That somehow that's what we should be doing in meditation. We should be like that. And of course, we measure ourselves against that the whole time. We are disappointed that we are not always attentive, that we are not aware and awake all the time. So people, as if it's someone else, we say things like, "Oh, I had a bad meditation. My mind was all over the place," or "I had a bad meditation, my body was uncomfortable and I was frustrated." We kind of measure ourselves the whole time against a very particular image that we have of this sort of static, monolithic, heavenly realm, really. And it means that we're, and then we attach to that, of course. We measure ourselves, we fail, we feel frustrated, bad Zen student. Let me try the Quakers, let me try the Tibetans, you know, anybody but this. And it's very insidious and often quite unconscious, I think. I'm going to suggest, this is my morning's revelation. You can see what I was doing this morning. I'm going to suggest a different kind of model. Of course, there are many, and it's only a picture, but the picture came to me of a kind of railway, of a train. And in the train, the railway carriage is going along. And inside the railway carriage, people are sitting down and standing up and they're talking and they're looking out the window and they're busying themselves with this and that and they play cards and they shake hands and so on. They fret and they worry, complain. But all the time the carriage is going about its business, it's moving along. Going from somewhere to somewhere else. It really doesn't matter that much what you're doing inside the carriage, if you're worrying about your tax returns, or if you're feeling that you didn't get enough sleep, or you're having the best day of your life. It really doesn't matter that much. The train's going along, choke, choke, choke. Anyway, I like that picture. You do what you like with it. Entertain me for a whole half hour. I just know in myself the kind of the speed with which frustration at one's meditation practice arises, and the words we use with that, and the way we hold on. And I think it's quite unnecessary. And I suspect it's a particularly sort of Western thing as well. The Indians, Japanese, Koreans and that I've practiced with really don't seem that troubled by that. It really doesn't matter that much. They come to meditation and they leave when the bell rings. I'm generalizing, of course, trying to paint a picture. But there isn't the sense of needing to achieve and needing to succeed that somehow seems to creep in. And measuring ourselves against a rather static and unnecessary model of how we should be. And the shoulds just seem to multiply endlessly, like rabbits. Rabbit practice. Okay. A breed of shoulds. Shouldlets. Please develop that as you. And I think it's at this time in the retreat too when we just occasionally get the sense of a space beyond that kind of anxiety, where we realize that something is happening, regardless of what we think, how we feel, whether we tell ourselves we're having a good day or not, whatever it is. That something is still moving. Something is moving, despite us. Despite us. Or perhaps in our absence, something very real is moving. Okay, so that's the entertainment slot. Now for the main feature. these discussions, we don't do them often, but it's quite interesting to have a discussion just because of the kind of questions that come. For me, it's very helpful. And one of the questions I think, Kellen, you asked really, why Zen as opposed to any other particular form of Buddhism? Mm-hmm. Because all the things we say about Zen are often the things that could be said about any other kind of Buddhism. So I thought perhaps I owed you a fuller answer than I gave yesterday. Although I do love the idea of just landing somewhere and going from there. Okay, sort of arbitrary quality of it is appealing to me. I think the quality there are a number of qualities. I hope to remember them all. One that immediately springs to mind is that it's a particularly Taoist element of Chinese Buddhism that I find very instantly appealing. I'm going to give some detail in a moment, in case these are all new words. Buddhism, as we all know, I think, began in India, northern India, about 500 BCE. And it developed there as a very particular small movement around a charismatic teacher and his followers, initially men, but strikingly for the times, women were allowed in and became part of it, albeit, if you look closely, as second-rate monks. But a particular style was developed, and one sees it in some of the, what we'd call the Theravadan practices today in countries like Burma, Thailand, typically, so on, and in spots everywhere. It's a very simple, it's a beautifully elegant, unadorned kind of practice. I don't know too much about it, but that's my experience of it. And some lovely teachers, very simple, very clear. But as that grew, and please, I'm going to generalize things to try and create a storyline here. It developed its own body of rules and structures and so on, became quite institutionalized. By the time of what we call the beginning of the Christian era, it was quite a formalized tradition. It then went another kind of into another kind of phase, which we call the Mahayana, which philosophically and socially altered Indian Buddhism fundamentally. I don't want to go into details there, but there was fundamental changes there. The notion of emptiness, which we chant about every day, the notion of lay involvement, the development of compassion as the other wing to wisdom. Those were all parts of Indian Buddhism by the time of the Christian era. The Buddhist monks that made their way to China around that time brought with them, obviously, Indian Buddhism. They were sort of missionaries. They went overland through the Silk Route and by sea under from Sri Lanka up to southern China. And they brought with them the values and style of Indian Buddhism, which by then famously had, I think, is it 274 rules the monks had to follow, mainly protecting the monks from themselves. again, I'm caricaturing, but just for simplicity. They didn't work, the monks didn't work, they avoided women, they lived in particular groups, they brought with them quite an austere practice and philosophy around non-self and a sort of causal interconnectedness and impermanence and so on. And karma, very strongly. You know, careful what you do, because next time around you'll be punished. That style. In China, already there were a number of indigenous traditions, most prominently Confucianism and Taoism. Confucianism, I think for the purpose of this story, was mainly concerned with harmonious social relations. So we'll just put them aside for the moment. Taoism had two aspects. One was a kind of religious yoga aimed at immortality. Fascinating stuff there. All sorts of elixirs that they ground endlessly, make themselves live forever, so on. And then what we call sort of classical Taoism, which was more of a kind of a nature, if you like, a kind of a nature path, a path of oneness with nature. Again, that's oversimplifying, but just for our purposes. So when the Indian Buddhist monks came into China, they encountered Taoist communities who lived in relative isolation in the mountains, working the land, mucking about, just hanging around, you know, being in tune. And the Chinese Taoist said, you know, cheer up. It's too wonderful to be so solemn. All your rules just give me constipation. All your thinkings, it gives me a headache. Come sit with us. Come listen to the rain on the roof. Let me hear your songs. What do you mean, no work? It's wonderful to dig the garden and eat what we grow. What do you mean, no woman? What do you mean, no children, no families? What do you mean, karma, that I can't smoke a joint if I and come back as a mosquito or something? So there's that that kind of it was that interaction that really gave birth to what we now call Zen. It was called Chan in China. Chan Buddhism. And what really happened was there was a kind of a marriage of the discipline and commitment of Indian Buddhism with the open-hearted, freewheeling love of life of the Taoists. And again, please excuse the words, I'm just trying to create a story here. And together they made a formidable combination. And we see that all those echoes in the tradition today, there's the traditional meditation discipline, the commitment to retreat life, whether it's full-time monastic or only occasionally on retreats, the Buddhist background, if you like, of impermanence, non-self, so on. Emptiness, compassion, wisdom. Those are all part of the tradition. And in addition, there's just an appreciation of this world, a sense that we are practicing in the world in which we find ourselves, and that it's here that we make our way. And if we make mistakes, that's fine. And sometimes we need to sing, and sometimes we need to dance. Sometimes we need to laugh and express our affection for each other. And in Japan, that element was developed in some ways further, became more concrete, more meticulous. And famously, out of that, the kind of very precise arts of poetry, flower arranging, architecture, gardening, martial arts, that kind of thing. Something's been left on the stove. More burning. The life in which we find ourselves. And no problem. So, and importantly for me, and perhaps the whole tradition, there was a change in the style of thought, if you like. Typically, a central notion in Indian Buddhism was interconnectedness, paticca samuppada, those who read the books. But it had more of a causal sense. I see the woman, I fall in love, we have a child, the child grows up, the child suffers, the child, that sort of stuff. Everything is interconnected, but in quite a causal manner. And it was very highly developed, kind of detailed, very detailed stuff, fascinating. But again, typically the Chinese Buddhist said there's too much thinking here. It's actually complicating things. Feels like I've got to stop living and think about it. And that's not my way, somehow. Can you sort it out?
Sorry.
So instead of this very detailed philosophy, let's find a picture for it, a metaphor. And they adopted a picture which they call Indra's net. That the whole universe is like a net of jewels. And each of the jewels reflects all of the other jewels in the net. So everything is part of everything else. Everyone is part of everyone else. Each of us contains and reflects the whole. That is the picture they had. Very clear, very simple, and aesthetic. There's an aesthetic about it. So rather than a lot of detailed philosophical analysis of things, just this one picture felt to them like it summed it all up. And that it was more true to the experience they had, the flashes of oneness and of belonging, of connectedness with each other, that was more true to that than the volumes of words. So, to come back to your question, I think for me that was a very attractive element in Zen that was in a way peculiar to the Zen tradition. I don't want to start comparison. Tibetan Buddhism had its own path, its own thing, its own color and so on. very ornate, very detailed, lovely, wonderful, exotic stuff. I wasn't able to make it my own, not because there's any fault in the tradition, but I just couldn't own it at the time I met it. But these aspects of the Zen tradition I find very appealing, I still do. Together with that is the, I mean, it's in all schools of Buddhism, but a very singular emphasis on going beyond the words. That you need to embody it. You need to manifest these teachings in your life, in this moment, while you're listening, while I'm talking. That's the only measure, really. Not your adherence to rules or regulations, although they may be part of it. Not how, what degree of monkhood you've attained or your status in the institutions. It's just how is your life at this moment? If these teachings, if these ideas and books help you, wonderful. If they don't, throw them away. So a radical non-attachment. Okay. A radical non-attachment. And the koan style of teaching, which is really just teaching by stories, for me is very expressive of what I've been talking about, of these qualities of Zen. That they ask of us that we really find out for ourselves what is true in this moment. Right now, as you are, with all your eccentricities and foibles and absurdities. And it's also, I think, necessary to remember that in this sort of combination of the traditions that gave birth to Zen, that however freewheeling Chiming may appear to be, or may be, sorry, however, what's the word? And no one knew if he was wise and foolish, wise or foolish. He'd already spent 30, 40, 50 years as a monk, coming on time, sitting dead still, eating monk's food, working in the kitchen, working in the garden, saying, following the schedule. It's against that kind of background that his freedom appears. And just while we're talking of koans, when I studied koans, I was always terrible at it. I studied in the Japanese tradition, and the Japanese tradition is very formal, or the monastic tradition. I mean, they all develop their own formality, but it's very, very formal. The teacher, the Roshi, is the sole arbiter of everything and is treated with great respect. And that is in every detail of your relationship with him as a monk. But in the koan meeting, at some point, you have to go beyond that teacher-student relationship and do what whatever is required, and he has to live with that. That's part of his measure. So, you know, typically at some point you will shout at him, or tell him he's talking rubbish. And that's just so that you're not attached anywhere. There's a kind of a freedom in the whole movement there. And it can feel astonishingly difficult to do that. The story I remember about Subong, what's her name? Teacher who used to come here. There's quite a lot about him in some of the books. I was the monk in charge of the Zendo at Mount Baldy, where I was a monk. And Subong came as a student. He was a senior student of Taesunsen in the Korea, Zen teacher. And Subong, I think on the first day, went in for interviews with Sasaki Roshi. Very formal. You bow three times. You've got these robes and you're falling over your feet. It's sort of chaotic, really. And interviews are seldom longer than about 30 seconds. So you've got to be sharp. And in the course of the interview, Subong stole the Roshi's stick, so it was a stick, and ran away with it. Roshi had asked him a question about the stick, and he picked up the stick and ran away. The next thing we heard was that Roshi was called a meeting of all the monks. We had to now expel Subong from the monastery. And he was totally, because we never quite knew what happened in there, but we all secretly admired him for running away with the Roshi stick. And Subong always said, I kicked him out of Mount Baldy. It's not actually true. But anyway, he liked to tell a story too. But that mix of formality and freedom and not attached to either of them. It's not just sort of beat Zen, doing what you like. It's not just monastic rules. Somehow, being able to live both of those, rain falls on the roof. I think what Robin also said yesterday, you meet a teacher sometimes who just speaks to you in a particular way where you are at that time. Someone who will be there for you, you know, however stupid you are, however wonderful you are. Says, hello, welcome back. Bye-bye when you go. And that'll change over time too. That's also fine. So we've been looking this week at the story of Chiming and the unfathomable woman and the head monk. Sort of and the monks, in the light of that, the monastery rules and disciplines, this sort of chaos at the bottom of the garden, the testing, the affection, the generosity, all of that just tumbling head over heels with itself. And in a way, that story kind of contains everything that we've been talking about, I've been talking about this morning. All those elements are there. So this morning I'll just wrap it up. I think we just need to acknowledge the monks in the story. So I'd like you to just remember them. I'll chat to you about it when I see you. And then I may have another little question. Well, enjoy the rain. Have a wonderful day. Okay.